Welcome! You're listening to the sixth episode of FemWonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and today we're going to chat about early learning and childcare both in Canada, particularly New Brunswick, as well as in Australia. I'll be joined by a former colleague, Mary Andow, who has been living and working in the early learning space in Australia for the last about 2 years. We have a great conversation. I hope you'll enjoy.
So today we're joined by Mary Andow. I met Mary when I first started working in the Premier's office. She kind of took me under her wing and really showed me the ropes, both with what was actually going on in the office, but from a policy perspective, she really showed me what kind of ability we had in the Premier's office to actually enact change and to influence policy. And she really was, in my opinion, a trailblazer in that office for moving forward with feminist policy. Mary's now living in Australia, so I do apologize if the call quality is a little bit spotty, but I'm really happy to have this conversation with Mary today. And I'll just toss it over to you, Mary, and ask if you would mind introducing yourself a bit further and letting us know what you've been up to on the other side of the world.
Thanks, Katie. That was really nice. I think it's probably an overstatement. I remember when you came and I thought you were the most successful recent university graduate I'd ever met. I wasn't really dominating life quite the way you were at your age. So anyway, I think I learned a lot from you too. So yes, I was in the Premier's office when Katie started. I was in opposition prior to that and then in the Premier's office after my first mat leave, and got to meet Katie at that time. And then as of April 2017, I've been living in Australia. I'm doing a few things since I got here. I had a second baby, which was probably the most major thing I've done. And about 7 or 8 months into that mat leave with my daughter, I did a contract with an educational policy think tank in Melbourne called the Mitchell Institute, which was really, really good. I got to sort of do a lot of similar things I did in the Premier's office in New Brunswick, but obviously getting a whole new perspective because it's quite different here. And also it wasn't in a political office. It was a think tank where you can sort of have great ideas and push them, but don't actually have the ability to implement them. So that was a bit different. I've wrapped that contract up as of Christmas, and now I'm trying to work a little bit closer to home.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mary. And I would say definitely having another child is probably a big milestone. So again, congrats.
Yeah.
thanks. So I'm excited to talk a little bit about the work you were doing in Australia. But first, I just want to get your perspective. You were really heavily involved in the work leading up to the creation of the free childcare program in New Brunswick. I don't know, while you were working on it, if that was kind of the form it was going to take, but I'd like your perspective on that and some of that work there.
So when I came into the Premier's office, I had a September baby, my first child, so I left opposition during an election and came back a year later. So I missed the first year. So when I was coming back, I was coming off of a maternity leave, and my son had been enrolled in daycare at 10 months. And so that was sort of, before I even got there, I sort of had my eyes open to a world that I hadn't previously understood or really appreciated, sort of the early learning, the early childhood sector. Once I got back to the Premier's office, I didn't really know what the priorities were right away. I was happy to find out that developing our and strengthening our early learning system would be one of them. And so, like, just to be clear, when I got there, there was people like Rachel Dion and all of her crew at the Department of Education who'd been sort of creating long-term plans of early learning, and they'd been working on it for years and years and years. So not as though I came in and was like, here's an idea. So they basically had a plan in the books for forever, and they've been giving it and working on it. And so yeah, I think it did end up quite a bit, like, but I think, yeah, I left in April, and I think it was announced in January of 2018, the actual plan, and it had, you know, free daycare under, for families earning less than $37,500. It had the sliding scale thereafter, which did that sort of what we'd hoped for, and it had lots of other good features as well, quality grants and all sorts of things like that. And so, yeah, I think they rolled it out. They did a pretty good job. There was a few things that I would definitely change about it, which we can get into later, but I thought it was great. I guess you're asking sort of why was that important? Generally, why was it important to me? I mean, for me, on a personal level, it was important because I got to see what the predominantly women working in these roles were doing day after day, looking after my child and, you know, here in Australia, both of my kids. And in terms of sort of the broader policy, I think for me, improving access to education for 0 to 5 year olds is the most important policy initiative in Canada. I really believe that. So just in terms of why it's important from a policy perspective, I'd say in terms of tax dollars, you're spending less in the K to 12 system on kids who are beginning school months or years behind their peers, which is what happens if they don't get any sort of quality early learning from 0 to 5 years. You're using money you would have spent on social assistance, on health, on crime, et cetera, and you funnel it into early learning. And so if you look at the average estimates of economists, the return on early learning dollars is $2 for every $1 spent, and that's pretty average. It's pretty, I wouldn't say it's a conservative estimate, but I would say across the board most people would agree with that. And if the child has disadvantages or has a disability of some sort, the estimate on the return can be up to 9 times higher than that. So if you're a child in a perilous situation, the return is going to be even higher. So like the OECD, so the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, has 3 broad rationales for investing public resources into, you know, high quality early childhood education care. And so I've mentioned a few of them. The first is economic and social payoff. The second is, of course, supporting parents and boosting female employment. So access to affordable care for 0 to 5 year olds obviously means that more predominantly women can enter or re-enter the workforce. But for me, and this one has always been most important, is that it's society's responsibility to educate children, to combat child poverty, and to help children overcome educational disadvantage. And so that's how the OECD outlines their rationale for encouraging countries to invest more in early learning. Yeah, there's tons of economic advantages. So a lot of, like, Nobel Prize winning economists will say for every dollar you spend on early learning in 0 to 5, it generates a higher rate of return than the same dollar you would spend on K to 12 schooling. So it has a lot to do with brain function and brain development and synapses. So if you aren't using synapses from 0 to 5 years old, it gets tuned back. And so by the time you start school, it's too late. So in terms of investing in a actual brain, you get more bang for your buck with 0 to 5. I have to say, and I don't know if you want me to talk about it now, but I do believe there's a global trend towards knowledge-based economies, and like we should be spending money on this for economic reasons, but those are never, ever, ever going to be my reasons. So I don't know if you want me to get into reasons that really matters to me, or if you want to go a different
route. Yeah, I mean, no, I would love to keep this train of thought and this conversation going, and I'll actually just say it's interesting that this is where I think this, or your train of thought has gone as well, because one of the main reasons that I wanted to start FemLonk was because I was tired of picking up the paper every single day and reading about, you know, how much X program was going to cost, or, you know, the debt in New Brunswick, or why we needed to stop spending on this and that. And I wanted to talk more about the real social value of investing our dollars in these ways. And I think that might be where you're going. So I'm going to let you keep going.
Yes, definitely. So yeah, look, like it's just, you could rate a novel on why it's a good investment. Like as a personal investment, if I wanted to, you know, invest my money in something that was a moral investment, an ethical investment, but also would give me cash, you know, in 50 years, I would absolutely invest in early childhood. It's like on PISA exams for 15-year-olds, if you did 1 year of preschool, you're scoring 30 points higher on reading. If you did 2 years, you're scoring 50 points higher by the age of 15. It's just like, you can go on and on and on, okay? So there's all these reasons, but for me, they kind of miss the point of what early childhood education has really meant to me, especially since I've had kids. I was in the political office in one way or another for a long time. And from a political perspective, I completely understand why that exists. And so you just mentioned, you know, opening the paper and reading people's comments about, you know, why do we have to spend money on this? We're broke, da, da, da. And that isn't policy, that's political. And it really annoys me, especially when it comes to like welfare of children. So the best and most straightforward example I can give is, so I want you like just imagine that I've moved back to New Brunswick with my family and my daughter, who's just, she's a baby now, but imagine she's in grade one. And look, I don't know what I'll be doing when she's in grade one. I might be gainfully employed, but maybe I won't. So let's just imagine that I don't have a job and I, you know, it's September and I rock up to grade one and I'm like, okay, have a nice day, sweetheart. And the teacher says, oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Ando, but you know, you don't meet the activity test and we're going to have to remove Rory from school. And so like, can you even imagine my daughter's K to 12 education, depending on what I, her mother, am doing or not doing and stripping of, you know, stripping her of her rights to an education because of it. And so like, you know, that sounds like sort of some dystopic stuff, BS, but, you know, everyone seems perfectly fine with applying that same logic to the education of 0 to 5-year-olds. And that's ridiculous because who decided that school starts at 5 or 6, wherever, depending on where you live, it's different, but it's an arbitrary start date. It's a start date that makes no sense. And yet, you know, we believe it's a universal right of the child to have that education. And then, you know, 6 months before, we don't believe that's a universal right. It's absurd. And 90% of brain development is occurring 0 to 5 years. And so like, why aren't we spending the money there? And why, when we do spend the money, are we tying it in to the activity of parents when, you know, the right of a child to education and care should have absolutely nothing to do with the activity of their parents? And so, you know, you talk about reading things, and I shouldn't read things because I just want to like throw my computer at the wall. It's like you read the New Brunswick Klan, which was wonderful in many ways, and people are out there having dependents by saying, you know, you're reading comments like, oh, well, I'm not going to pay for this kid to go to daycare while his mother lays on the couch all day. You know what? I don't care if that mother never gets off the couch. That's exactly who I want to pay to go to daycare. You know, like an investment in that child is much more important than an investment in, you know, a child who might be having a bit of an easier go at home. But, you know, regardless, I think whether the kid is from a family where both parents work and both parents are engaged, I think there's a million benefits to having a kid in early childhood education. Like me and my partner, we're, you know, we're educated. We usually have good jobs, and we are engaged with our children. We read to them. Like we are, you know, we blow a lot of things, but by the most standards, it's a pretty good parent. And that being said, the benefits our kids get are through the roof. Like I wouldn't dream of not having my kids in there. And so that's good for them. And so imagine the benefits to a kid who doesn't have what my kids have. Like they don't have engaged parents. They don't have parents who, not through any fault of their own, but because of circumstances they endured growing up, weren't able to get an education, have trouble with employment. And then having that linked to their well-being, it just sort of perpetuates a cycle of, you know, poverty or like low achievement or like low outcomes or poor outcomes, I should say, when instead we could be breaking it by getting those kids into care early, like quality care, quality early learning centers, and, you know, giving them the start that is making it a little bit fairer for them at the beginning. So, yeah, that's my take on that. I definitely am into the economic reasons, but I also think that there's real like moral imperative to take care of and educate children before the very arbitrary school start date of 5 years old.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that outlook. And I think a couple of things to take away from that are a couple of thoughts I've had. So I think on the one hand, like I totally 150% agree with you on, in most cases, the kids that need the early learning opportunities the most are the ones that are not getting that support at home. I think, and I'm not justifying this, but I think part of why there might have been that element of the if you're not working, you can't get the benefit, is the idea that childcare is too expensive and there are families that a parent stays home rather than paying for childcare. So I think that was probably that target, right? Like we're gonna provide the free childcare so then we can integrate folks back into the workforce. But I think to your point too, that's not the reality for everybody for whatever reason. So how can we make sure that the program is actually inclusive and expand it to those folks who, again, and the kids, through no fault of their own, aren't going to get that opportunity? And I'd be interested to know your experience in the Australia context, but when we spoke just a few weeks back, I mentioned the Quebec childcare program. Of course, that's, you know, kind of looked at across the country as a bit of a model. But just since then, there have been two, I think, different stories. So there's the one with Ontario considering canceling kindergarten, which is mind-boggling within itself. But then the other that I saw just today was British Columbia has a pilot project basically modeling after the Quebec model, where families are paying, I think, $10 a day. And just some of the stories coming out of those families, because you can just imagine the cost of living in British Columbia, so the cost of childcare is just as high. So that I thought was really interesting. So what I think is kind of, I guess when we talk about public policy across just Canada, for example, every province is doing something a bit different when we talk about early learning. However, a bit more standardized at that 5+, which I'm happy that you mentioned that kind of arbitrary line, because the other thing that I think is really interesting is it's the same when we talk about the valuing of childcare workers. Like, why is somebody who is teaching kindergarten paid exorbitantly more than somebody educating a four-year-old, right? So I think that that's the same thing. It's a bit of the undervaluing of early learning and undervaluing of the work of the folks working in that sector. I think that those are two serious barriers that we still are facing.
Yeah. Just going back and also like want to be very clear, I'm so impressed with the New Brunswick plan. And in addition to the new plan, they also held on to the daycare assistance program that they have. And so that also pays for, you know, underprivileged kids to get into the daycare system. So, and I should say that what they did in New Brunswick was extremely brave. Like, as you know, we have a lot of financial problems and a lot of people who might not understand that this is a great investment. And so to do that in the face, with sort of declining demographics the way we have is amazing. In Australia, which we can get into later, but just as a note for now, Australia is, you have to live here to get it, but it's just such an incredibly wealthy country. Like, it's, you think Canada is a wealthy country, and it is, but living here, it's so wealthy, and they've invested so much into early learning. But despite that, still have equity tests for parents. It's the same deal. Like, is your mother or the person who's working less, are they volunteering enough? Are they Are they in the workforce? Are they doing this? So even in what I is honestly the wealthiest place I've ever been to, they still put these tests on. So I think New Brunswick has done really, really well. Moving on, I actually hadn't read that story that Ontario was considering canceling kindergarten.
I'll send it to you. I might be being dramatic, but I'm not being dramatic. But basically, they've said there is like kindergarten will absolutely continue this year, but they've left like it open-ended about what their plans are, which yeah, like I find to be completely bonkers. Like I think even just back to Nova Scotia recently, I guess it was probably about 2 years ago now, but introducing universal pre-K. So, you know, you've got one province adding universal care for four-year-olds and another province saying like, oh, we're removing kindergarten.
So I was working on a paper about looking into Ontario. And so I looked in 2016, 2017, there was, it looks like almost 129,000 students attended junior kindergarten. And based on birth records from 4 years prior to that, it meant that roughly 91% of kids were attending full days of school 5 days a week for roughly 35 hours. If you don't think that's going to have an amazing long-term impact, right, through lunch, like that's amazing. And so I don't know why so in Ontario, like junior kindergarten, neither of them are mandatory, but sort of when you integrate something into the school system, you sort of look at that as, okay, it's time to start school. It's like the natural course of action. So I'm shocked to hear that. I mean, I know what's going on there, so I shouldn't be shocked, but like Ontario is a pretty decent model. Like they've got 4-year-olds into school already. They've got school boards who are offering before and after school care to match the parents' working days.
There's been a lot of public outcry. I just did a quick Google search to pull up an article, and they've basically just said it's not protected. And the article I read referenced that the program is, like you're saying, it's world class. It's in a category of its own right now, but it costs $1.5 billion. So again, we're back to this cost and exactly what you've just referenced there. It's obvious, like what else is worth spending that money on, right? Like particularly when you talk about, even when we're just thinking about the economies of the future, like if you stop educating people now, then you're basically screwing your economy for the next 20 plus years.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like, it's just, if all you can talk about on one hand is shift towards knowledge-based economies, but then on the other hand, say that kindergarten is expensive. Like you're hand A versus talk to hand B. It doesn't make any sense. But like, I think there's obviously a ton of problems with their program, but I have to say that they actually did it. Whenever it was the late 90s and they introduced their universal program, of course there's going to be problems. You're doing something that is revolutionary, basically. So there's going to be a ton of problems. And of course there has been, you've got their long wait list to get into their preferred centers, and you have a lot of parents going to other sources of care and getting a much more subsidy for those. But I think overall, you've seen the results. So you talk about women in the workforce. And so if you're comparing it to Ontario, the rates for women aged 15 to 44 went from 78% to 81% from 2003 to 2016. And in the same time period in Ontario, the rate dropped, so from 77% to 75%. So that ability to get back to work when your kids are little has obviously had a huge impact for them. I didn't know BC was trialing a universal $10 rate either. And I think, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about that. I definitely think it has some sort of like appeal in terms of putting the message out, like it's not complicated, it's for everybody, like it's cheap, you can do it. But from a like not simple policy perspective,
I think of it the same way I feel about taxation and taxation of the wealthy. And my view is that we should be taxing the wealthy. And I think that families who can afford it should be paying more or should be paying full fees. Like, again, I have mixed feelings because I think the impact of the message that says it's universal flat rate, anybody can go to take care of any child, any family, doesn't matter who you are. I think the thought has worked for them, and I think they have been successful because of that. But on the other hand, I would like to see families who can afford it. You can nitpick to that plan, but ultimately you just have to hand it to them for going for it and doing something that's really, really important. And of course, when you're doing something that huge and that important, it's going to be, problem.
Totally. I'm just cognizant of time. We've been having a great conversation here, but I really want to hear about your experience in Australia. So, yeah, I just would be interested in what you've observed in Australia in regards to childcare and kind of are there any lessons to learn, what can be improved?
Yeah, there's a bit of a mixed bag, but I mean, I remember, again, Rachel from the Department of Education, when she was working on the plan in New Brunswick, talking about quality, 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 quality. And quality in childcare is sort of like an abstract concept. Like you have your notes that says, qualified teachers, quality spaces, so like nice playgrounds, like nice learning environments. Like, you understand quality abstractly, but until you actually see it, it blows your mind. So we had looked at Australia a lot when we were in New Brunswick. And so when I got here, I was really interested to see what it would be like. And I mean, the difference is pretty impressive. But I guess what I would say about Australia and childcare and early learning is that it's a national imperative in a way that you just do not see in Canada. And the way you know that is you just follow the money. So we were obviously really excited to see the federal government in Canada committing to $7 billion for the next decade on early childhood education and care. And that for Canada is extremely progressive, but I want to put that into context for you. That is an announcement by a Liberal government in Canada where we do quite well on other aspects of, life with small children in terms of maternity leave. But here in Australia, where it is a conservative government, they are going to spend more than $10 billion this year on childcare alone. Yeah, so basically Australia is spending more than $10 billion this year alone on early learning and childcare. And we have, 10 million fewer people who live here than Canada. So there's lots of issues with the program here, but I have to say, you follow the money if you want to know if it's a national priority or not, and it sure as heck is. And so there's still issues, of course. Like I mentioned earlier, there's there's activity tests, of course, but there's also, loopholes for that. So if you're earning less than $67,000 a year, you get 24 hours of subsidized care regardless. So there are issues with it, but then there's, also a lot more money. So yeah, like definitely I would say follow the money. You can see the difference here. The second main thing, which I sort of mentioned, and it's obviously tied to the amount of money invested, is quality. And as I was saying before, I just sort of understood quality as an abstract concept. But they have here what is called a CEQA, and it's the Australian Children's Education and Care Quality Authority. And they have developed a national quality framework for their daycares and their early learning centers. I can go online at any time and see if my kid's daycare is meeting or exceeding standards or if it's rated as excellent, which would be rare, in 7 different quality areas. So like staffing arrangements, educational program and practice, health and safety, physical environment, things like that. And so I think that I'm in a unique position because I actually got to see sort of on the ground comparisons in the way we operate in the 2 different countries. I
I have an app on my phone, and every other day I have an alert that says there's a new story about Clemmer, a new story about Rory, and in it I'll get a full story of what one of them has done. So one of them is from a few weeks ago, is that Rory is playing with puppets, and she's you know, engaging with the puppets in an imaginary world. She's taking them across the room, she's pushing them in a cart, she's taking them to a farm, she's taking them to different locations, she's making sounds. And then I get this whole story, and then I get a list of the outcomes that are associated with that activity. So she's responding verbally and non-verbally to what she sees, hears, touch, and tastes, exchanging ideas, feelings, and understandings. So basically, I'm getting a report as though, for my one-year-old, as though she were in school. And I love that. And I get the same thing for Clem. Like, I know if he's, you know, working on his literacy or numeracy that day, I know what he's doing. And that is just amazing to me. But it takes money. Early in our conversation, you had mentioned, the qualification of the pay gap between what it takes to teach a five-year-old in Canada and what it takes to teach a four-year-old. Yeah, like you said, I think, what was it exactly? I think it's 59% in New Brunswick. So 59% for the woman who taught Clem, or the woman who was teaching the four-year-olds in New Brunswick in my son's daycare, versus the person who teaches those kids then 6 months later when they turn five. If you care about quality, and if you want to create pathways and career opportunities for educators, you need to create better programs. And that doesn't mean that everyone who's taking care of a two-year-old needs to have a four-year bachelor's degree, a one-year bachelor of education degree. You know, that's not what I'm saying, but we need more. So I wouldn't do more than a one-year diploma if the outcome for that was that I was not going to be paid well to do probably one of the hardest jobs on earth. There's no incentive. So we need to up our game in every single way. So we create better programs, we create better options for qualifying our early childhood educators, we pay them more so that the investment in their education is worth it. We then, that might, you know, sort of start to, you know, make us value them a little bit more if they're paid more for doing, again, what I would consider the hardest job on earth. People in Australia would certainly complain about the pay of early childhood educators, but it is just so much better than what we see in New Brunswick, and they have better pathways. Like, they can develop their careers. There's more qualification options here. There's ways for them to, you know, move along in their careers and, you know, be appreciated for the work they've done and keep moving up. And I don't think you see those sorts of pathways in New Brunswick the way you do here. And I think it's really, really important, because, you know, looking after kids and helping kids learn at that age is emotionally, physically draining. And if you think, you know, there's no room for me to grow here, it's, you know, that's why we see high turnover. People leave because it's so hard. So I think there's a lot we can learn, but we aren't spending the money they are here. And so if we if we spent a little bit more money, those are some things that I think could be a lot better in New Brunswick, in Canada. And I think Australia is a great example. There's lots of issues here, but the economy is booming. They spend a fortune on childcare. I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but I mean, their economy has been good for a long time, but you have to look at it and be like, definitely isn't hurting the economy to be spending what they're spending.
Yeah. Wow. That's really interesting. I think I mentioned earlier about how I can't stand the conversation around money, but I love, it's like you flipped it on your head there. I totally agree with what you're saying. Like, you can also see where the priorities a government is placing, or what priorities the government is placing based on where the dollars are being spent. Yeah, wow, I can't believe, those are some stats that I didn't know, and I can't believe how much. Well, the differential, really. And I think it's, again, it's pretty clear that obviously the outcomes are reflecting the inputs, I guess, is what I'll say there.
I definitely kicked myself in the face there saying I don't care about money, but you need to spend a lot of money.
Totally. Yeah, no, I know, but that's kind of a bit of where I come from it at as well. Like, I think we in New Brunswick, and I don't know, would be interested to know if this is a narrative at all in Australia, but in New Brunswick right now, particularly with, you know, just a more of a rise in the right around the world, all we hear about is balancing the books. And you know what? That's great. Well, we also hear about, you know, passing on the debt to our kids. Okay, perfect. But if we haven't created the conditions for our kids to, you know, have well-paying, meaningful jobs by having a high-quality education from, you know, birth to workforce, then, you know, who the hell cares if they're going to be paying off the debt, right? We haven't set them up for success.
Absolutely. Exactly. And you hear a lot of that, like, I don't have kids. Why do I have to pay for kids? And it's like, who do you think is going to pay for you? Like, if you don't have kids, somebody is still going to have to, pay for you. You're not getting any younger. You sort of need to, everybody needs to invest in society. But yeah, I don't know. It's like, yeah, you said the rise of the right. And I just think, like, I don't know, from like a sort of gendered policy perspective, I think this is sort of one of the most important issues, because look, like, there's a lot of people, and I would say probably more conservative leaning people, who look at daycare, and you've seen it throughout history, daycare plans have been squashed, and the rationale has been, I think Nixon squashed a daycare plan, and the rationale is that, you know, kids belong in their family, like family units, and families raise kids. But basically what they're saying is women raise kids, and it's the women's jobs to raise kids. And I actually have, like, no problem with that. I would find it really difficult to do myself. I would probably be frustrated. I think my kids would be worse off if I was with them every day. But I also, on the flip side, have friends who do that and do a great job, and their kids are not worse off. They're doing a really good job. And so I'm not all kids need to be in daycare all the time, but I think even for my friends who are really good parents and who are at home with their kids full time, if you look at what they're doing a minimum of 12 hours a day, every single day of the week. It's not like a job where you can just sort of like go for lunch. You know, you can't go for lunch. You can go for lunch, but it's going to be torture and your kids are going to be like throwing food everywhere. But you know, it's a job where you don't get to switch off. And so I think even for that segment of the population that thinks, you know, I don't need daycare because kids should be with their families, you know, you're basically saying you don't need daycare. And the predominantly, it's almost always women who are doing all of that work don't deserve a break because their job doesn't matter. You know, they do deserve a break. I think I would love for my friends who are stay-at-home parents have a day or two of subsidized daycare based on their family income, so they could do other things that you need to do to keep a house running. Like, I really value what they are doing. And when I say, like, oh, we need daycare, I don't always mean that we need daycare so that women can go back to work. Like, I think we need daycare so that, you know, women who are at home with their kids can work 60 hours a week instead of 80. Like, it's just, I think it's good for everybody. So
yeah, I think it's about providing options, right? Like, that's fundamentally
exactly
what it's about. Like, if, again, I totally agree with you. If you want to stay at home with your kids, that's fantastic. And that's great. But again, if you want the options, or if your household for whatever reason needs the options, then we should be able to provide those as well. And I love, yeah, I was just chatting earlier today with somebody about, you know, the historical undervaluing of women's work and the undervaluing of women's work and the assumption that they should do undervalued and underpaid work. And yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's an all day, every day. And you're like, those are also in a lot of cases the folks who are managing all of the household activities, not just the child care.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's everything.
Absolutely.
So
I was going to say, it all goes hand in hand. Like, I think, like,
if you improve your daycare system, you are predominantly propping up women who work in those fields. You're making that a more lucrative field to look into. You're valuing it more. And when you value women's jobs in like the greater workforce more, then that has to have a trickle-down effect to actually just valuing all the work that women have historically done more at home as well. So I just think, you know, it all sort of is interrelated.
Oh, completely. And that's it. Like, this is an overall complex policy discussion. It's not just about childcare. It's about, again, the valuing of women's work, about pay equity, about giving options for all folks to join the workforce and not having childcare as a barrier against that. Like, that's
exactly.
It's such Absolutely. A rounded discussion.
And I'm glad you brought that up because, and I liked the way that you framed it because it's not, oh, we're investing in this because we want every single woman to go back to work. That's not what it is. It's we want every child to have options and every, you know, family to have options, and then take from that what you will.
All right. I'm cognizant of time here. We've been chatting for a while. It's been a great conversation. And I feel like I've learned a ton. I'm excited to research the Australian model a little bit more, to be honest.
And it's funny you mentioned like Ontario, because there are some threats. Like, there's no outward threat, but there's sort of like in next year's budget, there's no funding listed for universal kinder. And there's a few things. And then there's like, I think I remember seeing potential funding cuts to ASEQA, the quality authority that I told you about. And it's like, they've done such a good job here. Why would you stop now? So hopefully it continues to be a model for the rest of the world.
Thanks again so much for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you want to stay in touch, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FemWonk. Feel free to check the website out, femwonk.com, and you can email me directly, Katie@femwonk.com.